Shed.
Hello, and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about the Meg. I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Maddie.
And...
Ty.
And we do have two guests in the shed with us today, but I'm not going to introduce you yet, because first of all, I have to tell you that we do have coming up three interviews.
So my name is Kaylee Burns, and I am a shark safety diver and biologist for One Ocean Diving, and we're located here on the North Shore of Oahu. And what we do on a daily basis, kind of every single day, is we take guests out from all around the world, all different abilities, diving with sharks. While we're doing that, we're really lucky we get to take research data variables. On the way out, we kind of teach the people about behavior, about the sharks, what species they're going to interact with, and kind of go over the whole experience. And then we take them in the water with sharks, and they have an amazing time.
Kaylee Burns is, you may have seen her in the news recently. She is one of the people who had that close encounter with the biggest, I believe, great white shark that we've seen, if not the biggest, one of the biggest white sharks that we've ever seen. That was in the media recently. She's going to join us later on
Deep
this
Blue.
Episode. Yes, Deep Blue.
Deep Blue.
That's
Deep
the
Blue
name.
It's the name of the shark.
That's Deep Blue Sea. Yeah. Deep Blue is the name of the shark.
Yeah, that's the one. And we also hear from Professor Adrian Mellett, a professor of astrophysics, who has just released a paper which says that the evidence in our planet suggests that the megalodons, stars of the Meg, were wiped out by supernova explosions far out in space. The other guest who we have is Steve Alton, who wrote the books that the film The Meg is based on.
You know, as a teenager, I always loved those subjects. I read Jaws and saw the movie when I was 15 and started reading everything I could about great white sharks. And there was always a little blurb about Carcharodon megalodon, the prehistoric cousin of the great white. And nothing ever really written about it, just usually a black and white photo of six scientists sitting in a megalodon jaw in the Smithsonian. But about 20 years later, I picked up a Time magazine in August of 95, and there was a cover story on the Mariana Trench and hydrothermal vents and deep water vents and creatures living in, you know, pitch blackness and huge colonies of life at the bottom of the ocean. And it sort of spurred me on to that little blurb that I read about megalodon years ago and thought, this might make a pretty cool story if it was feasible. I went to the library because there was no internet back then and did the research and realized that, you know, they could be down there. And I set the goal that I was going to write the book.
And joining us in the shed are a marine biologist and natural history filmmaker, Annie Moyer. Hello, Annie. Welcome to the Cosmic
Shed. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Very impressive how many people you can fit in here.
Yeah. And we also have Rick Barnes from Spin Up Science.
Yep, that's the one.
And you've done some research on sharks.
Yeah, I spent a year in America kind of helping out with some shark conservation work that was going on over there.
So welcome to the Cosmic Shed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ty, tell us about the film.
So The Meg is a long-in-development film about the prehistoric ancestor to the great white shark, the megalodon, which in the film didn't go extinct. It actually survived and lives in the Marianas Trench, where it's accidentally discovered by a group of submersibles, and through a series of circumstances, escapes to the surface, where it unleashes prehistoric hell upon everyone.
What's that?
There's a monster outside.
You people discovered is bigger than we ever thought possible.
How big is that thing?
It was the largest shark that ever existed.
A living fossil.
Thought to have been extinct for over 2 million years. Wrong.
Steve Alton, the man who wrote the books, can tell us about the film.
I want to touch upon the Meg's time in Hollywood's development hell, because obviously I first bought the book in 1998 when I was 15, and at that time it had a blurb in the back that said the rights had literally just been bought by Disney Pictures and it was on its way to becoming a movie. And over the years, Disney Pictures have held the rights, New Line, there have been directors like Guillermo del Toro, Jan de Bont, Eli Roth, who have all been attached to the project, and yet none of them ever kind of took off. As the author of The Meg, what was that 20-year period like for you?
It was like pulling a tooth. There were good parts and there were bad parts, and most of them were bad. What happened was is that before the book was ever published, before the book was even written, my agent at the time had sold the dramatic rights on a first-look deal to Disney's Hollywood Pictures. And they took treatment for the book, and the book that I'd written thus far, which was about three-quarters done, and started putting it into development. But what happened was is that the head of the studio, David Vogel, was fired, and then his assistants were fired as well. And when you change out a president of a studio, the incoming president never takes on the old guy's stuff, because if they're successful, then the other guy gets credit for it, so it's all about ego. So the rights reverted back to me. They were optioned in 96, and they reverted back to me in 98. And then in 2004, 2005, a friend of mine, Nick Nunziata, who was the founder of Chud.com, Cinematic Happenings Under Development, was friends with Guillermo del Toro and Lloyd Levin, who were the director and producer of Hellboy.
Yeah.
So I flew out to California, met with them. They read the book, and they really liked it. And they asked me to write a script. So I wrote a script. At that point, they had attached Jan de Bont as director, and Jan and I worked on the script together. And we took that package to New Line Cinema. And New Line optioned it, but they didn't want the script. They wanted one of their own writers to work on it. So they brought in Shane Salerno, who proceeded to change the entire story so that the book was unrecognizable anymore. And basically created a story about a sort of a Moby Dick story, that a whaler, or Tanaka, this whaler had left Japan and crossed the Pacific Ocean to California to hunt this Megalodon.
Okay.
And, you know, the script was, I hated the script and was very happy 2 years later when they never greenlit it, and the rights reverted back to me again. And then what I did was I took the rights to a friend of mine, Belle Avery, who was, her forte was in raising money. And so she had financed a couple billion dollars worth of movies in her past, and basically went on an 8-year spree of flying around the world, meeting with investors, meeting with production companies. And she brought aboard Gravity Productions in China, and they brought aboard the studio.
It's a US-Chinese co-production, so you've got Bai Ling Ling in there. You've also got Ruby Rose, Cliff Curtis, Rainn Wilson, my good friend Rainn Wilson from Star Trek Discovery. I couldn't get back in touch to interview with for this episode.
We've got enough interviews on this podcast.
Well, yeah. John Turteltaub of the National Treasure franchise, and our favourite episode of From the Earth to the Moon, directed it. And it's done very well at the box office, despite a bit of a critical kicking. But you know what? It's never going to be beloved by the critics. Expect sequels soon. Even though Jason Statham and John Turteltaub, even before the film release, said that they had made a much gorier version, and Warner Brothers essentially blunted the teeth on the film. So they went into it with the expectation of making one sort of thing, and the studio might have, you know, made it more family friendly in the editing.
Megalodon.
He's kidding, right?
I was never into the bloodiness. I mean, the books can be pretty violent, and there's plenty of blood in the pages. But, I saw it more like a family adventure, at least the first one. I think the second one is going to get a lot darker, which the book, The Trench, gets a lot darker. And I think that you sort of want to introduce the franchise in more of a family-friendly venture. So I was pleased with how Warner Brothers did that.
Annie, I got in touch with you because I saw your wonderful film, which we'll talk about later, A Voice Above Nature.
Yep, that's the one.
I saw that and I thought, right, let's get Annie in the Cosmic Shed. And I sent you a message and said, do you fancy coming? We're talking about the Meg. And you said...
Yeah, I've read all the books. I'm a massive fan. But it does get weirder than that. So for my 17th birthday, my uncle bought me a first edition of Meg because I knew I wanted to go and do marine biology at university. He bought me a first edition, sent it to Steve Alton in the post, and with, I think, maybe a $20 bill in there just so that he could post it back. And... he wrote a really lovely message, put a little bookmark of a Meg in there with the facts of like the size and everything. It was very cool.
Oh, amazing.
And then he did get a little bit of a sassy reply from Steve, because I don't think Steve realised that we were in England, so we had to go especially to the post office, which was, I don't know, a walk or a drive away to deliver this book. So yeah, he wasn't too happy with my uncle. But then I received this amazing book, went on to do marine biology. I am actually now a character in one of Steve's books. Cheers to that. I became a massive fan, and he does these competitions when he's writing a new book where if you promote one of his other books that's coming out, the top three people who get the most views get a name in the book. So I was going for the Meg series, didn't get that. I came fourth in this, like, how many views your YouTube video could get. Gutted. And the funny thing is we have to, when he does these competitions, you have to then submit like a bio of what you suggest your character could be. So I was very, like, tried to keep it to how I am. I was like a little British marine biologist with a brown ponytail, like action-packed and full of adventure. I ended up being a character in Sharkman, and I am a pretty 30-ish brunette wearing a sexy business skirt. So I ended up being very different from what I thought. And I think I'm like a bit of a triple agent baddie. Like, I'd go bad, but then at the end I turn up at the meeting with the goodies, so I don't know whether there's going to be a new book I'm going to turn a bit like good again. Ooh. So yeah, that was very exciting. And so I was very excited for the Meg book to come out. I've followed his newsletters for years now, so there was a lot of, like, not slow progress, but it went on for a while that they were going to release who was going to be in it and who was making it. So a bit of a fan of Steve Alton. Yeah. So is my uncle, and he's on the Meg Council now actually as well.
The Meg Council,
yeah. If you're a proper Meg head, Steve asks you to be on the Meg Council, and my uncle's on that. Wow. And it's quite funny because on the group they get a little star next to their names on the Facebook group, and I think like all the rest of the Meg heads kind of throw shade at the Meg Council people, and they're a bit like, oh, look at these guys, thinking they're the top fans. So, but my uncle's very proud of that. But yeah, that's the story behind the
amazing
me and Meg. So deep.
Yeah.
So deep.
You never thought that was going to come out, did you?
Do you know who won the competition to be in the Meg?
Oh, I don't.
Can I read you a section?
This is not true. You're wrong. I didn't win any competition.
Okay.
All right, so I should clarify. So I remember finding a copy of Meg when it first came out, and I think it was 1998. So I was 15, 16, and Jaws was my favourite film and still is one of my favourite films. And I found the book, bought it immediately, and in the back it said, Meg has been optioned by Walt Disney Pictures and is set to be a blockbuster film coming soon. I was like, this is going to be awesome. And so this was 1998, and for 20 years I watched this film never get made. And during my time between school and university, I was a frequent member of the Empire Magazine online forums, where I would just waste my time while I was working in a call centre talking about films. And I just started this entire thread about, here's this project called Meg about a prehistoric dino shark, the Megalodon. And for years, I just kind of tracked its progress of which studio had the rights, which director was attached, and the number of times it had been cancelled over the years. Basically, I sent the page to Steve Alton kind of going, there's a big kind of UK film audience that's really interested in the Meg. Do you have any update? And every now and then he would kind of reply going, no, it's still in development hell. But he was very appreciative of me sharing the word. And he said, would you like to be a character in the book? I was like, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's how I ended up as a character in Meg 4 Hell's Aquarium.
Nice, that's my favourite one.
Hey, there we go.
Yeah, it's cool.
Seated in his command chair, sipping a mug of hot coffee, is the ship's captain, Taiman Singh. Is just under 6 feet, with short, dark, curly hair, bushy brows, a large... A large Roman nose that matches his rugby player physique.
What?
Half white, half Indian, his complexion is bronze, his accent British. He dressed in khaki trousers.
Which I'm wearing.
He fucked it perfectly.
And a leather jacket.
Oh. Yeah.
Well, yeah, normally.
Normally, yeah.
That's quite a flattering description.
Really cool.
Yeah.
He's pretty spot on, I would say. His expression almost bored.
Nah, that's how I generally look, yeah.
As he glances at David, a worn toothpick dangling from his mouth. Do you want to read your mind?
Oh, do I want? Okay. So you're the prize submersible pilot we've all been waiting for.
Amazing.
There we go.
Was it worth the wait? Was it worth it? 20 years.
Well, this is interesting because for all those 20 years, I've had different ideas of what the Meg film could be. You know, it could be like a horror film, you know, in a post giant shark versus mega octopus and Sharknado world where shark films are £1 a penny, they're mostly played for laughs, and you get the odd dramatic shark film like Open Water or Bait or something. But generally, people go to shark films for a bit of a laugh, and I think striking that really serious tone would have not made the film as successful as it was. And to date, it's made like 550 million worldwide. So I think striking a tone of a kind of tongue-in-cheek adventure film made it the financial success that it's been, especially with British national treasure Jason Statham.
Showing this, you ugly...
former member of the national diving team.
No wonder he's so fast at swimming.
Without flippers.
Do I wish that there was a serious version of the film that's, you know, terrifying? Sure, but you know what? I enjoyed it. I wish it could have been more gory, but I understand that, you know, obviously they wanted everyone to see it, and making it PG-13 brought in the money. Annie, what did you think, actually? Because you've obviously also been waiting for 20 years.
Yeah, quite a while. And like I said, for ages in the newsletters, it was always like, coming soon, potential news on... And this went on for months and months and months.
Years.
Yeah, literally years. There's a little bit of a bitter side of me for this, though, because after I went away after my marine biology and did some work with sharks and... then knew I wanted to make films, I did email him, because he's really good at replying to emails,
he appreciates his fans.
I emailed him saying, I've dived for sharks, I'm going into wildlife filmmaking, if there's anything I could help you with on this film, I'd love to. And he was like, thank you, Annie, we'll bear you in mind. So there's a part of me that's like, come on, you needed my handiwork. But I'm not sure how many real sharks there are in the film.
Probably none.
Yeah, no, well, that's... I actually have only just watched the film, so I was desperate to go see it in cinemas while it was here, but I've actually just watched it on a plane really badly. But it was... After the wait, it was very different, like you said, but I completely agree, you know, with Sharknado and the amount of films that kind of take the mick out of sharks, in a way, after Jaws was so successful, no one can top that. Like, it's just in its own standing, but... Jonas Taylor wasn't quite what I... Jason Statham as a choice wasn't quite what I was picturing.
More. I was picturing Dennis Quaid.
Exact same, actually. Like,
really?
So Jason Statham more for, like, Mac, maybe.
Sure.
But, no, Dennis... That's so weird
Dennis
to say
Quaid,
that, because I think that is the only name that me and my uncle have thrown out, weirdly. But, yeah, no, I liked it. It was what it was. It was... After reading the books, I mean, I'm kind of gutted that she didn't give birth to the three pups at the end of the... Was that in the end of the first book?
I think it's at the end of... Yeah, the first book ends with the Meg giving birth, which helps spawn the...
Yeah, just before they kill her, right?
Several books that come afterwards. So I was surprised that that didn't happen.
I'm kind of not surprised that that didn't happen.
Yeah, that might be a bit of a...
I suppose that they can definitely... make it happen, couldn't they?
Oh, they can just go back down the trench and find another one.
Exactly. Like, all the babies would just be there.
They'll just go, oh, wait, they gave birth before we killed it.
One could just appear anyway. One did in the movie, right? Just the second one.
Just came up. So I was like, where'd that one come from?
On that tiny boat which managed to survive the massive shark attack.
So, Rick, have you got any history with it, or do you...
No, none at all. I hadn't even heard of it before I watched it. I didn't realise there were books. It was entertaining, but I wasn't particularly enthralled.
It's fair enough. I wanted Jason Statham to at least roundhouse kick the shark in the face, and that never really happened.
I mean, he did swim straight towards it, you know.
Yeah.
Just with some goggles on.
That's why he's a national treasure.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to outswim it and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is very impressive.
I'm glad that little dog survived as well at the end. Yes. No spoilers. Well, spoiler.
Yeah, Pippin.
The dog always is going to survive. Mm. And Pippin is the name of the dog in Jaws.
The black lab, yeah.
Black lab gets eaten.
Yeah,
that's
right. Yeah. Trivia.
I should probably say, we normally do a spoiler warning, but... nothing happens in this film that you wouldn't expect to happen in this film, so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
It's fine. You literally don't have to see it if you don't want to.
It's like every cliche you could ever imagine.
Also,
every kind of plot.
As we're surrounded by like marine biologists, one of the tragic side effects of the success of Jaws was that people became terrified of sharks and lots were killed as a result. That's not going to happen with the Meg.
No.
If you made sharks terrifying again, and seeing as sharks are hunted and finned in horrific numbers, it's almost good that it wasn't played in that horror mode.
I mean, they're not really ever going to be like a cuddly toy that you're like, oh yeah, shark. I mean, they are cuddly toys.
Hang on, isn't there that child song all about Mummy and Daddy Sharks? Aren't they exactly that right now? Stop.
Where I was going with that is that, do you guys have a favourite shark?
I like lemon sharks, mostly just because those are the ones which I had the most experience with. And they're quite big, actually. They're quite big, and I think they're quite attractive sharks. Is that a weird thing to say?
Sexy sharks.
Sexy sharks, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm waiting for them to do, like, an animation where they make the shark look super attractive, like they're doing, like, The Lion King.
So what is your experience with lemon sharks?
But basically, in South Carolina, there's about 10 species of sharks. Most of them are quite small. However, whilst I was over there, I was lucky, and I just came across lots of these lemon sharks. My first shark which I encountered was a lemon shark, and that was almost...
Do they taste of lemon? Why are they...
I have no clue. I have absolutely no clue why they call it a lemon shark. Most of them, like, you know, the black nose and things like that, you can understand the naming, but the lemon shark, I actually don't understand why. I'm sure there's a reason. But yeah, the first one I got my hands on, the first one I actually held was a lemon shark, and that was probably close to 2 meters. They are bigger, which obviously makes them just more kind of grand. That's my reasoning. You know, I came across a lot of smaller sharks as well, but they didn't wow me as much.
Pajama shark.
You just made that up.
You can watch the Green Seas episode of Blue Planet 2 and you'll see them on there. I have been bit by a pajama shark, so that's why they're my favourite.
Are we going to get into like a Jaws-esque scar comparing scene?
Well, no, my uncle, again, was like, pick it, Annie. Like, I was in South Africa at the time because these sharks are endemic there and they're striped. That's why they're called striped pajama cat sharks. I was working at a science research lab for specifically sharks, and every day we were snorkeling out into the kelp, dropping a bait canister and then diving down, catching them and then tagging them and releasing them again, measuring them and stuff. You'd be on the surface looking down and you'd see a shark arrive, and the moment you realised it was a pyjama shark, your heart would sink, because the first month I was there, we barely caught any, so these were prizes. If you could get a pyjama shark, it was the best. But they are blooming strong. They're only just over a metre, so I think they're 1.5 metres, but they are, like, so strong, and I don't know why, but I held it weird, and it whipped round and clamped onto my hand like this. I instantly then spat out my snorkel and tried to swim about 50 metres in choppy South African seas, carrying a shark, like, I'm not letting you go. We're measuring you, and then you go in again.
Why don't you just put a tracker on it? You guys ever watch Shark Week?
Yeah, little soft spot for the biter.
Wasn't trying to eat you, it was just trying to...
No. So, yeah, I'll try and make... Sharks aren't scary, everyone. Well, it's just a defence mechanism. They don't want to be caught. And another species that you find there called the shy shark actually donuts up. Yeah, no, so it donuts up and it brings its tail over its eyes like this into a little ring. So they're quite easy to swim back with because they do that because they're scared. But, yeah, a defence mechanism. Like, it's completely understandable. I wouldn't want to be plucked from when I've just thought I'm about to get some dinner and then all of a sudden someone grabs me. But it was all safe. You know, they're kept underwater while we're swimming them back. We literally have them out of the water for... We used to always time it 1.5 minutes, just dipping them in other waters as well while we measured them up. And took a tagged them on and stuff and sent them on their way. It was very good. They did a lot of good stuff there.
There's an Octonauts episode with Norman Sharp. Apparently they have an unusual yellow-brown colouring that resembles a lemon.
They have a bit of sheen, don't you? Yeah. A bit of a shimmer.
Muddy?
Yes.
Did you enjoy the film?
Oh, wow. Well. I messaged you straight away, like, what a film. That was a film. It was entertaining in, like, the, like, oh, this is really cheesy and cliched. And then I really enjoyed the, like, close-up shots of Jason Statham, like, trying to show emotion.
Oh, I thought you were going to say topless or something.
Oh, well, you know, that was
the chemistry between him and Bai Ling Leng.
Incredible.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. Incredible. Non-existent.
Exactly, for all those kind of reasons.
Exactly.
I guess the lack of acting, really.
I don't think I've ever knowingly watched Jason Statham in anything.
This is shocking. I mean, he is the star of the Expendables film, Fast and Furious. Look, as someone who works for Physics World, you should appreciate the Fast and Furious films, because physics don't apply in those films. It's incredible.
Okay.
I've seen Deep Blue Sea, which is when Ty did his, like, science versus film dissection. That one was obviously also utterly ridiculous and absurd.
How dare you? Science in that film, I believe, with my GCSE in biology, was sound. Have you not seen Jaws, then?
No, I actually haven't.
What?
No. Nor have I.
What?
Big confession. Yeah. Oh. I've been to where it was filmed, though.
Massachusetts.
Hmm. Yeah.
Martha's Vineyard.
Yep. Yeah, where the biggest threat isn't sharks, but lice.
Really?
There you go. That's one of the highest...
Should we have, like, just thrown powder at you before you came into the show?
No, don't worry, I'm all right. I'm all clean.
The shark in this, the megalodon in this, looks good, right? I kind of like the way it looks. I think it's okay. And I'm watching it on a pretty big telly, and it worked for me. And I just wonder whether, if Jaws had been made now, when they could make the shark look good, would Jaws have been not as good a film as it is?
Yes, it would not have been as good as it is. The whole reason Jaws works as a horror and suspense film is because the shark fundamentally didn't work. So in the opening scene of the book and of the script, like when Christine is out swimming, a shark was like meant to come out of the water and it was meant to be like a spectacular bloody scene. But because the shark model wasn't working and sank most of the time, they had to improvise with the whole pulling her on ropes and the whole three barrel scenes where they're firing barrels into the shark to keep it afloat. That came about again because the model didn't work and they needed something to represent the shark, so that when you couldn't see the shark was there and the audience knew the shark was there, but you couldn't see it. So the whole level of suspense and mystique around the shark made it more scary when it did appear, was simply because the model kept breaking and they just had to improvise.
Yeah. That kind of fed into the way that films were made after that, right? People started making films more suspenseful by not showing you the monster.
You can compare it to, like, Jurassic Park as well.
Yeah.
Like, Jurassic Park, the scariest bit in that is when the water shakes and there's no dinosaur in shot, but it's just that suspense. And now when you compare the Jurassic Worlds, they're, like, just different films because, they can make incredible CGI dinosaurs, but the best thing about the film is when the goat's waiting to be eaten and it's still there and then it disappears. And that's, like, horrible. And it's the same with Jaws. Like, when they're waiting and there's just the beeping of the barrels getting closer, it gives you chills.
The opening scene of Jurassic Park, when the builder is getting torn apart by a velociraptor, you don't see the raptor. You see a glimpse of its eye, and that's it. And you very rarely see the dinosaurs fully exposed because it was a combination of CGI, it was still in its infancy, and massive animatronics by Stan Winston, mixing the two. So you had the lifelike models and then the CGI. Whereas now you can just do the CGI, and there's no real restraint, which Spielberg had to do. I keep saying this. This Steven Spielberg got a very promising future ahead of him. Yeah.
It's raining in the shed. You can probably hear that. I hope you're enjoying the rain, everyone. It's not raining in the shed yet. That will happen, though.
Atmospheric.
As you can see, and beyond the spider's webs, there are holes that rain will come through at some point.
Can I also just say, as the guy who runs the Bristol Bad Film Club, if you're looking for another Megalodon film to watch, and why would you not be, can I highly recommend Shark Attack 3 Megalodon with John Barrowman?
Whoa, really?
Yes. John Barrowman, pre-Doctor Who, post Live and Kicking, made a film in South Africa, Shark Attack 3 Megalodon, where he takes on a Meg. And it is spectacular.
All right, you two. Get some sleep, huh?
Yes, sir.
We'll meet back here at 8 a.m. Don't be late.
I'm exhausted.
Yeah, me too, but, you know, I'm really wired. What do you say I take you home and eat your...
We did a charity screening of it in June for the second time. We've shown it twice now to coincide with the Meg's release, and it is...
Maybe a third time?
Spectacular. You know, I can just lend you the DVD.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
Same. Well, I'm kind of... When I was watching it, I was thinking, why is this not Bristol Bad Film Club bad?
Because there are badder mega shark films.
Yeah.
It's a subgenre. There are so many B-movies out there of giant sharks.
Why is this just kind of an okay throwaway fun thing to watch, whereas those things are so bad you watch them because they're bad, whereas this you watch it because it's fun and slightly bad and slightly good? What's the difference? Why does that happen to a film that it goes there or ends up here?
Well, the Meg had a budget and it's got certain skills behind it, so the shark looks good. It's a good shark. You've got good stunt work. You've got a cast like Rainn Wilson, Ruby Rose, Cliff Curtis. They know what film they're in and they're just having fun with it. Shark Attack 3 Megalodon is meant to be set in Mexico. It was filmed in Bulgaria. A lot of the actors are Bulgarian and badly dubbed. John Barrowman is having the time of his life acting in a completely different film. His female co-star is trying to play it as straight as anything and he's not having any of it. There's a submersible that changes size every time you look at it. Most of the footage is just stock footage of sharks. The shark keeps changing size, and when you do see it, the CGI is terrible.
Yeah.
It's basically lots of badly formed CGI people just being thrown into the mouth of a stock footage shark. The bad guy dies by riding his jet ski accidentally down the mouth of the Meg while trying to make a getaway. It's hilariously bad. But very fun.
Yeah.
So that's why.
But when they're making that, do they know it's going to be that bad?
Well, I've interviewed the director, and he's just trying to make the best possible film he can. But he kind of hints that when you've got John Barrowman not really taking the subject material that seriously, it just becomes a whole other film.
Yeah. He cast him, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to do some science. There was a paper released recently which said that the megalodons don't exist anymore, quite possibly, because supernova explosions, exploding stars far out in space, caused their extinction here on Earth. And the man behind that is Professor Adrian Mellett, and I spoke to him recently, and I started by asking him what the evidence was for that claim.
That is iron 60 found in deposits on the Earth. Iron 60 can only come basically from a supernova. It's carried on dust grains that end up hitting the Earth's atmosphere and depositing on the Earth. Well, the evidence is a slam dunk for one supernova, and there is less certain evidence for there being a chain of maybe a dozen, not too far from the Earth over several million years. With a big spike 2.6 million years ago, which may indicate the closest one. There was one then, definitely, but there's some evidence for perhaps up to a dozen over several million years. There's also a cavity called the local bubble in the interstellar medium, which is pretty large, and it's essentially an area dominated by hot gas and empty of other clouds and things. These kind of structures are typically formed by chains of supernovae going off one after the other and kind of blowing this hole. The evidence on the Earth fits with the formation of the local bubble also.
So what makes you think that that would be the possible cause of the extinction of things like the megalodon?
Well, we began looking at the various effects, and what we discovered was that the increase in cosmic ray flux and then the muons on the ground from that were much larger than people had suspected. Then we did computations of what happens when these cosmic rays hit the atmosphere. Well, most of them are stopped in the upper atmosphere, but they produce showers, and the showers of elementary particles include a lot of muons. Muons on the ground is probably the biggest effect on life on the Earth. And muons are extremely penetrating. They hit us on the ground even now under normal conditions, but something like 100 to 300 times more would happen around the time of the supernova. And they would even penetrate into the ocean down to a depth of maybe a kilometer. And that would mean a big increase in radiation for creatures in the ocean. And the big creatures would experience the biggest effect, because normally they only experience it on the outside, because most kinds of radiation we get here on the Earth are not at all penetrating. But muons are extremely penetrating. So the interiors of these very large creatures would have a huge increase in the amount of radiation they're exposed to.
And then that would possibly have an impact on their evolution.
Yeah, well, there are two big things you get from radiation: cancer and mutations. Cancer especially could have contributed to extinction. And of course, in the fossil record, what you see is these things exist, then after a certain point, they don't exist anymore. You don't see soft tissue fossilized in a way that would tell you anything about cancer.
So, but what you're saying is essentially it's a coincidence, a strong coincidence of timing and effect.
Yes, that's correct. We calculate these effects, we see that they're substantial, and then we see that there's a mass extinction of megafauna at this time. And so we suggest that there may be a connection.
Where did it start from? Did you think there's the supernova, what effect did they have? Or were you looking at the supernova and then found the coincidence? How did that happen?
Over the last 15 years, this has been a game of, well, these kind of things should have happened at one time or another. Let's talk about them in a general way. In this particular case, here's an event. You know about when it happened. You know about how far away it was. You know what kind of an event has happened. So you can much more definitely calculate the effects than you could. I mean, there are still big uncertainties, but it's a whole different ballgame when you know how far away the supernova is.
My understanding is that the most likely supernova for us to see in our lifetime, but probably not in our lifetime, is Betelgeuse or Betelgeuse. If that went supernova today, would it have that effect on sort of the blue whales?
No, it's further away.
Okay.
So it would be very dramatic. It would be brighter than anything in recent times, certainly. I mean, you'd be able to see it in the daytime if it were in that position. But the effects would be much lower than what we've talked about, because it's substantially further away.
Okay. So we're not likely to see this having an impact on the evolution of blue whales in any near future and for us?
I think there's no large supernovae likely within a million years. Radiation events, however, should not be ignored. And there are two reasons for this. One is there are type 1 supernovae and gamma ray bursts. And some of those can happen from progenitors that you cannot see at the present time. For example, a pair of neutron stars circling one another, getting closer and closer, go off and make a gamma ray burst. There could be one of those out there now in the dark getting ready to whack us. But that sort of thing is only likely to happen at a dangerous distance every few hundred million years. So it's not something to worry about very much. The big threat, besides, of course, asteroid impacts, is solar flares. There's increasing evidence that there are large solar flares that go off. They're not powerful enough to do much to living creatures on the Earth, but their effect on our technology could be disastrous. Power failures that last for months, the destruction of virtually all of our satellites, GPS, communication satellites with their circuits fried. This could easily happen tomorrow, almost without warning. And the governments of the world are not paying enough attention to it.
So what could they do?
Three things I can suggest. One is to put up more warning satellites that would tell us if this is coming. Second thing, harden the existing satellites, put in protections for their circuits. The third is on the ground, you put out a warning, and for example, you open up all the power lines, you shut down all the electric power, put breakers in every 100 miles or something. The big threat from these things on ground is large induced electric currents from magnetic field fluctuations. Those can burn out anything that's connected to the electric grid, most particularly transformers. So if you have enough warning and enough sense, you can open the circuits so that there cannot be a large induced current. Trouble is, the people at power companies, this threat is not on their radar, and they don't understand it, and they typically don't know what to do.
Okay. Does that mean I should turn my computer off at night?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
And more importantly, I would say, be sure you have a surge protector.
Yeah, okay. Fantastic. Thank you so much for talking to me. It's really great.
Okay.
Cheers. Bye.
Thanks to you. Goodbye.
Do you know how many sharks, how many people are killed by sharks every year?
6 or 7.
Well, it is about that. Do you know how many sharks we kill?
100 million.
Yeah. That is a conservative estimate, apparently. Anywhere up to 237 million sharks killed every year by people. That's about 11,500 on the conservative end per hour killed by people, and about 7 people killed by sharks every year. And we're supposed to be scared of them. You guys have been in the water with sharks. One of them bit you. These are small sharks.
Yeah, these ones were. I have cage dive with great whites as well, which was very cool. And I think a bronze whaler turned up as well. We were convinced before by the guy. He was like, you'll see nothing but great whites. They'll all be great whites. And then this like bronze whaler came over. He's like, also bronze whalers.
What's a bronze whaler?
So they're the ones that, they're very bronze in colour.
Mm.
Another type of shark? I don't know really how to explain it.
Yeah, like a whale shark? Or?
No. So it's not a filter feeder. So it's got teeth. It would feed on fish. Similar to a tiger shark, maybe in size.
Okay.
Smaller than great whites. Although the great whites we were seeing were juvenile. So I actually think this bronze whaler was possibly similar size to the juvenile great whites. Or white sharks, they'd like to call them in science a bit more. But yeah, no, the great whites were incredible. There was juveniles moving through the South African currents, and I think we were waiting for ages in this freezing South African water, and they were like, they'll say, well, we'll call when there's one coming close, and they didn't call. And then all of a sudden one just erupted out the water right in front of us. I was like, there it is. But you stick your toes out of the cage, which is horrible. There's a bar that you
and you're wearing
your
flippers
feet. Well, no, so you just got booties on, but you don't have flippers on.
Okay.
But yeah, you have to rest your feet on a bar, but your toes poke out the edge, and when you're just there in this murky, white shark-infested water, I'm like, my toes, no, I don't like that. But yeah, no, it was very cool experience. Saw them better from the boat, though, than in the cage.
So, good to know.
Yeah.
Why did you see them better from the boat than in the cage?
Just because you're higher, and you can see them coming, and obviously when you're at surface level, and the water was, like, really murky, not very good visibility, so if you were under, you couldn't see where they were, which was like part of the, again, not seeing them was part of the scare, which was kind of cool.
Yeah. So you're doing it for the scare, right? That's the kind of the thrill of it.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, they're incredible animals. Like, I'm blown away by, when we start marine biology, they always say, you know, everyone comes here loving whales and dolphins, but you'll leave loving shrimps and crabs. But I left still loving whales, dolphins, sharks. Like, I think they're incredible. So well evolved for so many reasons. And so, yeah, I think just to be in the water with such incredible animals just is mind-blowing. I mean, like, now I'm a little bit more ethically aware. I probably wouldn't go cage diving, not going to lie, but this was 4 or 5 years ago now. But, I mean, it is incredible to see. And if it raises people's awareness about the animals and makes them respect them more, then I think sometimes ecotourism, as they call it, is definitely a good thing to do.
Are there space whales? This is what I want to know. Are there, like, giant whale-type things?
Well,
moving around space.
I didn't ask anyone that.
There are other forms of intelligence on Earth, Doctor. Only human arrogance would assume the message must be meant for man.
You're suggesting the transmission is meant for a life form other than man?
At least a possibility, Admiral. The President did say it was directed at Earth's oceans.
Maddie, you just need to watch Jaws.
You need to watch Jaws.
There's like a whole bit where like Chief Brody's learning about sharks and just regurgitating facts. Like, did you know that most shark attacks happen in 4 feet of water?
That is
like
the coolest
10
part.
10 feet from the coast. And oh, it's great.
Go watch it tonight.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Not tonight. It's too late to watch sharks for movies tonight. You've got to be able to give yourself time to watch something afterwards. Well, I do anyway.
Voyager.
If I watch something scary, yeah. Voyager. I always have to watch Voyager afterwards. So, we did speak to Kaylee Burns, who is from One Ocean Diving, and they're a freediving company off the coast of Hawaii.
So, you don't have cages. There are other cage tours around, so sometimes people that prefer a cage, end up coming with us afterwards, after they realize, like, okay, these animals are not at all what I've built them up in my head. And most of the reason is, unfortunately, because of the media. The media typically portrays sharks as man-eating monsters, not only in the overly dramatized movies, but on very rare occasions when there is a negative interaction with a human and a shark. People always like to highlight that, but they don't talk about the every single day when sharks are totally knowing what humans are and going past them, and yeah, everyone's perfectly safe every single day that enters the ocean. It's very relaxing, actually, to swim with sharks because they're so beautiful. Just watching them swim around is really nice.
But the first day that you got in and there were sharks there,
definitely for me now, I'm so incredibly used to it. And the best thing is that I've gotten to learn the behavior of the animals and how I should behave to make sure that everything is safe. But I'd say most people, their first time, they're definitely going to feel the nerves. But it's pretty interesting because you'll get people come out that are really, really nervous. And as soon as they get in the water, you can slowly start to see sort of transformation with their body language and, you know, just their demeanor. And they're really calming down after a little bit. And a lot of people actually come out saying that it's a very calm, peaceful, almost like meditative experience.
And what kind of behavior do you see from the sharks then when you're down there?
So typically they're very, again, very, very relaxed. That overly dramatized aspect that you get in the media is totally false. They spend probably about 90% of their lives just cruising, conserving energy. You know, they're in sort of a survival mode. There's only about, I'd say, like 5 to 10% of their lives where they actually are, you know, hunting, and they need to sustain themselves, and where they will turn up that behavior. But they're actually really, really polite predators, and they give you a lot of signs with their body language if they're uncomfortable with their presence. Just like if you have, you know, a cat on Halloween, they're going to arch their back, they're going to hiss, they're going to let you know when they're starting to get uncomfortable with your presence. And sharks will do the same thing, but if we're not used to speaking their language and reading their language, then we just miss a lot of those signs.
Yeah.
They do communicate with their body language and their swim patterns, and mainly with each other, very closely side by side to one another, right behind each other, or even dropping their fins if they are getting a little bit more agitated, or, you know, if it gets to a level of like slightly opening their mouths or fluffing their gills, then things like that will start to be more increased behavior.
Obviously, you get out of the water in that case, right?
Yeah, if it's to that level where we ever thought, you know, hey, the sharks are competing right now. Maybe a bait ball of fish is coming by. Maybe they're actually hunting. Maybe there's a female in the area and the males are kind of getting territorial. And we can always just pull people out of the water. We do have 100% perfect safety records. There's actually never been an incident whatsoever. You're way more likely to get hurt tripping and falling, just getting on the boat, which is ironic about the whole thing, but you can't get complacent because they are wild animals. They're not puppy dogs, and you just have to make sure you're always aware, super aware, looking around, looking behind you, just being fully present in the moment and watching the dynamics between the animals. And if anything we thought was unsafe, yeah, just give them a little break. You know, we can hop out of the water. There's a few different things we can adjust, even like as simple as turning off the engines, which provide an electrical stimulus for the animals. So even something like that can actually just mellow out the behavior, and you would be surprised to see how polite they are. I would not take my chances in the lion's den, I don't think. So.
Yeah. Cool. And what kind of sharks is it that you typically see?
What we usually see, we go to a sandbar and Galapagos shark aggregate site. So they are pretty common, the same sharks a lot of the time, that are just staying in this sort of area. They will do little migrational patterns at different times of the year. So sometimes we have more heavily sandbar shark population. Sometimes we have more heavily female Galapagos or male Galapagos. And we see those trends. And we also really enjoy swimming with tiger sharks that also kind of have their own season. And on occasion, maybe a scalloped hammerhead or a oceanic black tip.
Right. Wow. And do you see different?
That's the typical.
Okay. Right. So I've got a feeling that everybody who's listening to this conversation will be thinking, yeah. But what about the great white sharks?
Yeah. We had heard that there was a dead sperm whale carcass on the opposite side of our island. So we went to survey the sharks, see if there's any sharks that we have seen before and recognize that are in our ID catalog, as well as observe shark behavior, because as I was kind of just saying, it is very rare to get to see, especially tiger sharks together and interacting and behaving together, because most of the time they are very solitary. So that was our initial goal. The first night we observed multiple tiger sharks feeding on the carcass and their behavior, and it was very interesting, very good for the research. And we had gone out again a few days later, and with the same intention in mind. So we were just hanging out, and suddenly I just saw a very large animal on the other side of the whale, and I didn't know exactly what it was, and I was pretty certain it wasn't tiger shark. So we approached closer, and we could have never imagined what happened next. We all got in. They confirmed it was a white shark, and as soon as my mask hit the water, just the sheer size of this animal was so overwhelming and breathtaking. It was such a large white shark. It was actually really beautiful. It was my first white shark, and so I always kind of thought that I would be nervous in this scenario, but it was almost just as awesome and peaceful, and if not more, you know, relaxed than a smaller shark, because she was so big and completely gorged on whale, maybe even pregnant. It was like you could get out of her way really easily. You're a lot faster than her. Yeah, surprisingly enough. I mean, still a very massive, powerful animal. Definitely a lot of respect for this animal, but I did not feel threatened by her in any way. Yeah. She's very, very calm. Her movements, very slow. There was even dolphins that showed up and were kind of rubbing on her. So if that's any indication of how kind of gentle giant she was. Yeah, it was really amazing.
So it's a very busy scene with all the different sharks and dolphins and you guys in there. And is it, do you sense that every kind of living species in there is focused on this enormous white shark?
She was definitely the highlight of the show. All of the other sharks around did leave. And that is very typical. A larger shark coming into an area where there are smaller sharks, they will typically, sometimes you get the very, very confident smaller sharks that will stick around. Mm-hmm. But these sharks definitely gave her priority, gave her space, got out of her way, and submitted to her by just leaving the area and dropping down deeper, just completely, you know, taking off. The dolphins showed up a little bit later. We had gotten in with her and we saw, she was kind of cruising around. We did observe her feeding as well, which was pretty spectacular thing to see, especially seeing that and not feeling like it was very clear that she knew what her food was. You know, she came up, she wanted the whale. and you know, would just pass by us very gently, but just on her way to the whale, you know, she was very aware of what her food was, which was amazing. I really enjoyed making eye contact with her. It was a lot more personable. Like, people kind of think that they just have these black, soulless eyes, but it didn't feel that way at all when it was actually in person, you know, kind of see the soul behind the animal.
Yeah, brilliant. And it so you've got that kind of the initial excitement or thing going on, then you've got this peaceful feeling. When you see her feeding, do you feel the power of those jaws? And
yes, again, it goes back to these animals are not, like, we don't recommend that everyone go and swim with a white shark, as amazing as I know it's sounding as I describe it, because it was definitely the highlight of my life thus far.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they are very powerful animals because, yes, they are predators and they're doing what they're supposed to do, and they do have teeth and things like that. But they're very good at knowing what is food and what's not food, and we never give them enough credit for that. But what's also important to keep, like I was saying, if you don't know how to read the behavior, if you've never interacted with sharks, we definitely do not recommend anybody jumping in to swim with a white shark.
Yeah.
We had this perfect scenario with this exact white shark. She was, you know, really not desperate at the moment, had plenty of food source there. You know, she was slower, just her demeanor. She's a little bit older potentially, so she's kind of been around. And if we would have had it maybe like a male juvenile, a little bit more desperate, who knows the last time he's actually gotten a meal and things like that, then I'm not saying that he would have attacked us or any of the sharks would have, but you don't want to get complacent and just think that it can be like this every single time.
In the books, the megalodon is essentially a bioluminescent white. And
Yeah, albino. And it's also, when it first comes up, it's blind to the light, isn't it? So yeah. It hunts at night because it's like, its eyes get burned or something, doesn't it?
So really? It stays underwater a lot.
Surviving at those kind of pressures at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, the difference in pressure also, from being that deep and then coming up to the surface, though.
So for what's fundamentally a ridiculous concept, Steve Olton did put some thought into whether a creature like this could survive, what it would look like in his books, and I did ask him about this when I spoke to him.
Well, if you look at the other species that are at the bottom of the ocean, living in darkness, living in the abyssal zone, most of them are albino. And so I thought, well, you know, that would be pretty striking, like you said, if you had this 70-foot great white shark that was an albino. And so from a visual standpoint, especially, that's the way I was leaning toward it, and my fans have sort of identified with that. But I understood why they didn't do it, because, you know, when it came to the special effects and putting it on film, it didn't look real enough.
I was wondering...
They did try, though.
Yeah, I imagine they did lots of tests on it. Your book does kind of argue the science that a megalodon could exist in the Marianas Trench, theorizing that there's an entire ecosystem that lives off thermal vents, and that the change in water temperature would prevent megalodons from coming up to the surface. So how much research did you do into all of this to kind of make it as realistic as possible for your book?
Well, all my books are, I do a lot of research. I call them facts, and sort of fact mixed with fiction, so that you don't, the lines blur. And with Meg, you know, one of the things that I had hoped that they would get into the movie, which they really didn't, but I'm hoping that in the second movie they do, is the science behind what the story is. Because I think they did a great job with the visuals, but they didn't do a great job with the explanation, because you're limited on how much screen time you have. But hydrothermal plumes were discovered 5 years after I wrote Meg, and these plumes are like these entrapments of water at the bottom of the ocean that are sealed in by this layer. So you actually have sort of a warm layer off the bottom where life can exist. And of course, these hydrothermal vents are pumping 700 degree Fahrenheit water into the bottom of the trench. And, you know, this has been going on for millions of years, because the whole area in the Mariana Trench is basically a zone of plate activity. The Mariana Trench, the Philippine Sea Plate, is pretty amazing in itself, where the Mariana Trench is, because you have this small oceanic plate that's literally surrounded by trenches.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably the most volcanically active area in the world.
And while you've been listening to this podcast, 11,500 sharks have been killed by people. Annie.
Yes.
You made a film.
I did.
It's called Voice Above Nature. I'm going to be honest, I like it a lot more than the Meg.
Sorry, Steve. Should have got me to film it for you.
Tell us about the film.
So it's not about sharks, but it's about whales. And it's about how the effects that we, and the use and our exploits of marine ecosystems, ferries, military sonar testing, marine construction, shipping traffic, how all of those things contribute to noise pollution in our oceans. And we get thrown so many different types of pollution, plastic, chemical, lots of different types. And noise pollution is one that often slips under the radar purely because we can't even imagine the concept of how a whale communicates and how important sound is. It for all marine ecosystems. Reefs make sounds to attract fish back to their breeding grounds. There's so many different uses of marine acoustics, but I focus mainly on cetacean acoustics and specifically humpbacks. Even though humpbacks aren't the most affected by noise pollution, I just find their calls and their acoustics powerful and just beautiful, and people use them for relaxation, and there's YouTube videos of hours long of humpback songs. So that was a really good way to represent it, I felt, for the film. But my film is 12-minute short documentary, and it's fairly immersive, and I basically wanted to make people feel the issue of noise pollution instead of scream about it at them and use very traditional filmmaking techniques like interviews. I wanted to immerse people into how it would feel to be an animal that can't communicate, which is so, you know, we learn every day about how important and how clever whales are. You know, we learn all the time about how crucial they are to ecosystems and how complex their interactions are with one another, orcas, their family hierarchies, and toothed whales, how they can navigate with echolocation, all of these things that are just incredible. The fact that we're hindering them in something so crucial, it breaks my heart to think. So that's why I made the film. And when making the film, I collabed with a composer and sound design guy called Dan Pollard, and he'd come across something called cymatics. So cymatics is where you play a frequency through water and it causes the water to vibrate. And this has only ever been done before with like funky frequencies for YouTube videos. People, you know, play cool sounds through it and they use it for music stuff. So we wanted to use that to represent noise pollution because we thought it'd be a really cool visual. And then on the day, I think he might have tried it just before, but he went, let's whack some humpback acoustics through the cymatics, Annie, let's see what it looks like. And it honestly blew my mind. Like, when I first started my marine biology degree, I think I put in my personal statement that I wanted to discover one thing about the oceans that's currently not known. And studying humpbacks, that's quite a hard thing to do because they are probably one of the most well-known whale species, if not all marine species. And seeing for the first time, so this has never been done, humpback acoustics displayed in water was just absolutely mind-blowing. The patterns it created was just so... whenever the sound changed, the patterns would change, and it just was incredible to see. You could almost look at it like a language, and that was really, you know, there's lots of variables that affected the size of the plate. There's probably a lot of science that goes into it, and maybe what I'm seeing isn't scientifically accurate, but at least it shows how beautiful their calls are. And then what we've done in the film is we've brought noise pollution in over the top of those acoustics, and it just completely masks out the sounds and you lose them completely. And for a little while you can still see the humpbacks fighting through, but eventually the plate of water just becomes a bubbling mess.
Who's listening, you just heard the filmmaker talk about it, and I second everything. I mean, it is absolutely stunning to see that, and it really brings home this issue of noise pollution in the oceans. So yeah, thanks for making it.
Oh, no, thank you.
And the short film's available to watch on YouTube.
Yes.
Voice Above Nature.
Yeah, Voice Above Nature. It's like I said, 12 to 13 minutes. And the one thing I ask is that you either watch it with a good sound system like Andrew has, surround sound TV, very impressive, or a good pair of headphones, and that's, yeah, to get the best of the whale calls. That's the key.
It's phenomenal. We should all watch it again, and we'll post a link to it, obviously, on the Cosmic Shed website, thecosmicshed.com.
Thank you.
I did see that director John Turteltaub did seem to be making some sort of comment on plastic pollution with that shark POV shot where it's swimming towards the beach and there's sunglasses and suntan lotion bottles on the bottom of the sea the closer he gets.
Yeah, I didn't get that, but yeah.
Okay.
I think I was too busy looking at the massive great big shark to notice.
Yeah.
Is the way that they were putting the trackers onto the sharks in the film anything like what you guys were doing, or was it very different?
What, shooting a gun at them?
Yeah.
No, not for me. He's hectic, you know. You wanted to do it as quickly as possible, kind of induce as little stress as possible on the shark, even though it was insanely stressful for us, and then release it back into the water.
What kind of data have you got out of it, do you know?
They basically track the whereabouts of these sharks, and so when they're on, when you pick up the shark, not only do you tag it, but you also you identify its sex, you measure it, and then you also take a DNA sample. And so they've used all of that data to kind of try and identify which sharks reside in which habitats, and also just look at like population levels as well. Shark populations are in many places under threat, and it's really important to kind of keep track of them. And not only just is it about the data, but also just the physical act of tagging the kind of local fishing community, because when they find if they accidentally find a shark that is tagged, then they are significantly more likely to then release it back into the water and say, hey, we found a tagged shark, you know, and we released it back, which is not only good for us in terms of the data, but it's good just in general for the shark populations. One thing which I did find fascinating when I was over there was Hurricane Matthew, which I had to be evacuated for. A few weeks prior to Hurricane Matthew hitting was almost all of the sharks in the South Carolina area, the Whinnier Bay area, they all migrated, they all disappeared. They knew the storm was coming, and then probably about a month or two later they all returned and we all got the bleeps and the acoustic tags again.
So okay. Shark babies eat each other?
Yes. They do, often. We actually often found half sharks, because as one was on the line, another shark would come and just chomp on one. But this, in some species, the sharks actually eat each other within the womb. It's crazy. They're quite, they're not nice to each other.
And shark mothers have been known to eat their young, so as soon as they give birth, the baby sharks have got to get out of there as soon as possible.
Which is why the sharks I work with in South Africa are cool, because they lay shark egg cases. So have you ever seen a mermaid's purse on the beach? That's actually a shark egg. And so there's some species that lay eggs, they swim around kelp, they leave these eggs to hatch for maybe 6 months or so, and then eventually a little baby shark will come out of it, and that the egg case then floats the top and washes on the beaches. So if you ever see something that looks like seaweed but it's hard and it's actually like a little case, they call them mermaid's purses, that's a shark egg case, which is fun fact for you there.
Keep a lookout.
Speaking of mermaids, Kaylee Burns. Most people don't get to swim with any sharks, right? And most people's experience of sharks is watching Jaws or megalodons in the Meg. Have you watched those films?
I have, but honestly, from the perspective of reality, they look very silly. They look very like just completely dramatized and made up characters. It's just, yeah, even like the graphics just aren't good. You should watch documentaries like Shark Water or Racing Extinction or Mexico Pelagico, A Plastic Ocean, stuff like that, especially Shark Water, and the second one is coming out, which will actually show you the truth about sharks. So if people want to see the real reality of the situation, that's, you should definitely go with the documentaries, then you get a better sense for it.
Sorry, I got one last question on
it. Okay, that's okay.
It's shark finning.
at shark fin soup.
Yes, absolutely. I'm so glad that you brought it up, because usually, you know, I have to bring up that conversation, and it is something that we really want to talk about and highlight, because that is why we're doing this and why we have the entire conservation aspect of our team, is to conserve these animals and conserve nature. And it is really sad, because we can have these beautiful, awesome, you know, interactions with sharks. And that's why we're so blessed that we were able to get so much media exposure, you know, and podcasts. We thank you guys for calling us and reaching out to us, because we want to spread the truth about sharks to eliminate that fear, in hopes that if people weren't maybe so scared of sharks, they might want to help and protect and conserve the animals. And they need it now more than ever because of shark fin soup. As you said, definitely commercialized fishing in general can be very detrimental to sharks, the way that we fish these days with long lining and various nets and trawling. It does cause a lot of bycatch. So if you want to help sharks or any marine life, you know, always eating less or more sustainable seafood options are great. But especially in various parts of Asia, it started specifically in China, they actually consume shark fin soup. So sharks all around the world, the animals are being killed. They're caught into the boats. The fins are sliced off. The rest of their bodies thrown over. This is not something that they survive. They do die after this, a very slow and painful death. It's very, you know, inhumane way to do it. It's extremely unsustainable, because the rate, actually, over several decades of studies, is that sharks are being killed an estimated about 100 million sharks annually, which is about 2 to 3 every single second.
Whoa.
So, yes, it is a startling number, and I really, you know, don't even want everyone to take my word for it. Like I said, go watch these documentaries, Google it, you know, look it up, do some research on your own as well. But it is very startling, and it's happening all around the world, and even, you know, places where finning is banned. For example, here in Hawaii and Florida and various places, even in the U.S., we can't turn a blind eye from it, because even if the finning is banned, yes, there are illegal operations that get caught, because there's not enough enforcement into it. And then not only that, even in the U.S., we still do import and export the fins. So it's huge. They're still coming through here on their way to these different, you know, maybe from like South America, on their way to Asia, they'll pass through even our own countries. Right now, there is a petition going around on the Instagram of Jim Abernathy that anyone can go sign a petition to stop the import and export of fins in Florida. So that would be a huge help, and that's something everybody can do right now to help with the shark fin trade, because it is really brutal.
Yeah. Okay, we'll post a link to that, obviously, on the Cosmic Shed website. And
that would be beautiful.
We've had people from Hawaii on the podcast before, astronomers using the telescopes there. We've spoken to people looking at space and people looking into the oceans, and I'm thinking maybe I'm just going to have to move there. It sounds amazing.
Oh, you will at least have to come visit it and make sure that you come dive with the sharks with us. When you do, we would be so happy to take you out.
Oh, brilliant. Let's do it. Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to make this podcast because... it ties in the book, right?
The fourth book.
And I want this film to carry on to the fourth, so I can see someone who looks like Ty being Captain Time and Sing.
I mean, who could possibly fill the captain boots of Captain
Time? Wait, are you in talks to actually be in a film?
I mean, I could happily play myself. I mean, arguably, who's more me than me?
Yeah. But by the time that comes around, you're not going to be...
You're saying I'm going to age out of the role?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
They better get making these movies.
I've got time. I'm a 30-ish sexy brunette, so I've got time for the big shot.
I don't think it stated my age. It said rugby player physique. I mean, now it's more kind of rugby player who's totally let himself go and
I don't know.
Really
rugby,
likes
rugby
cheese.
Rugby caters for all sizes.
That's true. Okay.
Don't do yourself down.
Okay.
The other reason why I wanted to do it was because I wanted to kind of talk about sharks. The place that they hold in the ocean is incredibly important from the ecosystem point of view. I think from our point of view, we need to think about them differently. And we need to stop thinking of them as these terrible... Kaylee's phrase. I don't know if it's her phrase. I've never heard it before, so I'm going to attribute it to her. Of polite predators, I think, is a brilliant thing. That's how I will think of sharks from now on. Ah, it's Darwin Day next week. So I'm
going to... That Paul Bettany movie?
No, we're going to do... So there's a guy called Jordan Culver who's done... He's an amazing illustrator. He's done a comic all about the intersection between science and religion. Seems like a good time to do that. And I've had too many beers. So we should end the podcast. Thank you so much to Rick
thank
and
you.
Annie.
Thank you.
For joining us here in the Cosmic Shed. And thank you, as always, to Ty and Maddie. It's not always, is it? But regularly.
Occasionally.
Before we go, actually, Maddie, you've not been here.
No, I have not.
You nicked in for a bit of the advent calendar. And I did introduce Rick earlier, a spin-up science. Mm-hmm. And you're spin-up science too, so tell us what it is before we go.
Yeah, so the reason I haven't been here for a while is because I was finishing off my PhD and I got sucked into the thesis hole.
Hang on,
so...
should we be calling her Dr. Maddie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We're just cheapening it.
Dr. Maddie. Yeah, so that is a thing that I've done and moved on from and wrote 250 pages about. Ugh. Graduating in a couple of weeks, which is very exciting.
Cool.
Yeah, so obviously I couldn't really handle coming and hanging out in the shed. I didn't have the capacity to do it. It was sapping my will to live, writing my thesis. But sad story over. So I now have a job in Bristol again. Yay! Working for Spin Up Science with Rick and a couple of other cool people. And we work to support entrepreneurship in science. So kind of connecting people that are doing really cool and exciting and innovative research in the university. Making them aware of the kind of process that they might need to go through to like commercialise that research and get out into the world and do some good with it.
We're building bridges. Building bridges between science and the real world.
Okay.
So
just like this podcast. And by the real world, not the real world.
Obviously, there are more creatures, without spoiling anything for people that haven't read the books, that will show up in the sequels, because down in the Marianas Trench you've created an entire ecosystem. Is this something that you're hoping the sequel will explore, or do you have any indication about where any potential sequel will go?
Well, as an author, you always want them to follow the book as closely as they can, and I'm sure they'll follow some of it, not others. But the book that Jørgen Mels make has Aquarium, which is the fourth one. That book really changes the series. As you mentioned, it opens it up to a much wider menu of prehistoric sea creatures. And so I think if they did the trench, which they're working on now, mm-hmm. and they sort of follow the basic strokes of the trench in the novel, that it'll lead them to make Hell's Aquarium, and that's when we really get into the serious mano-a-mano or shark-a creatures battles.
And finally, with everything that you know about megalodons, everything you've read, all the research that you've done, do you believe that there's a chance there could be a megalodon somewhere in the Earth's oceans?
Sure, I think there's a chance. I mean, you know, people who say that it's extinct, how do you know that? Because only 5% of the ocean has been explored, and only 1% of the deep water. And these were not dinosaurs that lived 60 million years ago. You know, these were apex predators. These were the biggest, nastiest shark ever to inhabit our planet. And they lived, you know, anywhere from 30 million to as little as a million years ago. So that it doesn't mean they suffered the same fate as the dinosaurs. It just means that there's something that happened that reduced their numbers. And could they still be out there? Sure, they could. Because, you know, you have to realize that a shark doesn't have the surface to show its telltale dorsal fin. It can live in the mid-waters, it can live in the deep waters, and just inhabit them forever.
And hopefully we'll hear news any day now that Meg 2 is going to go into production. But Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today for the Cosmic Shed, and I hope we finally at least get to Meg 4 just so we can see Captain Timon Singh on the big screen.
And there is an opportunity for you to be another character. I'm going to be writing the next sequel in the Locke series, and if you go on my website stevealton.com, there's actually a book. The book is going to be pre-sold starting on February 1st. And And the first 250 people to buy will have a chance to be a character in the story.
So what you're telling me is there's a chance I could dominate both of your franchises?
I think you're up for a lead character position myself.
I mean, this is exciting. This is exactly what I was hoping for, so I'll get on that right now, and hopefully all our listeners will also go to stevealton.com, buy your book, enter the competition, and hopefully we'll be joining Meg Movies for many years to come.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for everything. Have a good day.
The thing's out there. You need to find it and kill it.
Definitely check out Shark Attack for Meg on John Barrowman. John Barrowman.
Yeah.
Get him on the shed.
No.
He looks heroic, but he's kind of got a negative attitude.
And thank you very much for listening.
Cheers.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
Females don't have claspers. Males have two elongated...
Claspers?
Claspers. Like, so what do you call it? Like an appendage? No, not that.
Penis.
They look like penises. Yeah, I'm not going to lie. But there's two of them side by side.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's how you know it's a male. Whereas,
yeah. I've got to edit that. Not me saying, yeah, like that.
doing the finger thing. They can't see the finger thing, damn it. So they're two long penis-like looking parts of a male shark, which are their claspers. So that's how you can identify if you're swimming under a shark. If you happen to be swimming under a shark,
yeah,
that's how you'll know it's a male or a female.
Okay.
So yeah, in the book, he grows two claspers. He's like, what the heck? Jumps in the water and develops gills and turns into a shark. And so the military go after him. And I'm a PR lady, so yeah, I start by helping him, but then I like reveal where he is or something. I turn bad, but then I do. Yeah, I think I redeem myself towards the end. But I'm hoping there's going to be a shark man too.